Hey, welcome to another edition of the podcast Old School Guns. I think we're up to number 31 now, so we've made it past 30. We're the podcast. We're not affiliated with anyone. No one tells us what to do, think, say, endorse, or anything. So what you get here is the unvarnished truth as we see it. So we hope you enjoy this. And again, we're on Podbeam. We're somewhere on iTunes. And so you can definitely, you can probably find us there. And go ahead and hit the subscription, follow, or like, whatever button you can push. And one of those will get you a notification to when the next podcast is posted. So without any further ado, we'll just kind of jump into it. We're going to do something a little bit different this podcast. I've got one political issue to cover, and then we're just going to go into some Q&A because there's all kinds of questions that are kind of piling up. And that's my favorite part anyway. So we're going to go one issue and then Q&A. And that one issue has to do with President Donald Trump, who I'm a Trump supporter simply because I think he's the best advocate and the best guy to represent us when it comes to Second Amendment rights. I mean, the other stuff is all the other stuff. And what a president does, a lot of it is just things the president does, regardless of who it is. But I think that Trump has got, he can at least listen to reason and have our best interests at heart. And, you know, part of that was Wayne LaPierre, who everybody's down on, basically called him and said, hey, this background check deal is a bad deal, and here's why. And probably explained him the facts of how background checks really work. And when Trump saw it, he basically took those off the table. You know, it's really funny that after red flag laws were the topic of the day with all these people, until it was suggested that maybe Chris Cuomo should be a subject of red flag laws after he just went psycho on some guy, you know, who approached him and called him Fredo. So Fredo Cuomo, basically his behavior has kind of led people to think twice about red flag laws. Plus the fact they're unconstitutional. Depriving someone of something without due process is just unconstitutional. But the real issue to talk about is, I saw this, it was a disturbing headline actually. It says, Trump, you know, tries to give himself the Medal of Honor. And I'm like, well, this can't be true. Nobody is that big of an egotist that saying, well, since I'm the president, I deserve a Medal of Honor. And as it turns out, it was the worst media lie spin that I think I've read in a long time. I can't remember. There have been bigger stories that have been spun, and this is not really a big story. But this has been spun so hard, I don't actually think I've seen one that's been twisted this much. And this tells you about the authors, the media, and everybody else. And the crux of the story was, Trump was speaking at an event where they had veterans, and they had some World War II veterans there. One guy in particular was a Medal of Honor recipient. And so Trump does what Trump does. He speaks off the cuff and he says, I think the guy's name was Joe. He said, hey, Joe, you're looking great, fantastic, great people with the Medal of Honor. You're great Americans. And then he kind of is joking, going, well, I'd like to have the Medal of Honor, but, you know, I don't think I could give it to myself. My aide said that wouldn't be a good idea, that I wouldn't be eligible. You know, he's joking around with the guy. It's clear when you read the transcript or actually see the, there's a little clip of it somewhere on the internet. He's joking with a nice old man who basically has got our highest award for valor and gallantry in action. And, you know, Trump really pays homage to those guys. And if he wants to joke with them a little bit and basically said, well, I'd like to have one, but, you know, I don't qualify, that's okay. And I would defend any president that said that. If Barack Obama had said that and people were accusing him of wanting to give himself the Medal of Honor, that would never happen in the media environment then or now. It would never happen. But I would defend him just the same. He's being nice to a person who has gone above and beyond the call of duty. And he basically, whoever the president is, yes, they have a right to basically speak with those people, kind of joke with them, and make them recognize them for the national treasure they are. And that's what Trump was doing. He's never considered giving himself a Medal of Honor. That's just horrid, vicious, ugly spin. And frankly, I think that a person who can come up with, when you read what Trump said, and you kind of see it, to come up with the way they were talking about it, I think you have to be mentally ill. I think that many of these reporters, you know, they're mentally ill, they're twisted. And you see them on Good Morning America, you see them on CNN, you see them on MSNBC. They're twisted, they're bad people. They're very, very bad people. And we got to put them out of business. And the best way to do that is to tune them out, and it's to challenge them with the facts and with common sense. But they're very, very bad, twisted, ugly people. And they shouldn't be trusted with forming the opinions around your gun rights or conducting their media drumbeats for gun control. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. And they essentially kind of are. They're the people who make David Hogg, that kid from Parkland, who wasn't even at the shooting or anything. They're the ones trying to give him his 15 minutes of fame over and over and over again. And basically, this guy's a nothing. He's a piece of paper. He counts for nothing. Yet they keep trotting him out, trying to give him some visibility. I think the last thing we heard from Hogg was there were like 7 assassination attempts on him or some nonsense. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. And, you know, it shows you what our media has become. You know, I hate to say it, but, you know, we used to laugh in the old days at Pravda, you know, and there was other communist publications that were pure propaganda. We used to laugh at them and say, God, what terrible, look what garbage that they put out for consumption. But now, our own media, the mainstream media, and to a degree, even Fox News, look at some of the bozos on Fox News, it goes right along with it. I mean, they are worse propagandists than what ever worked for Pravda. So you should think about that whenever you hear these people. It's always terrible when you hear a news story, especially when it concerns Trump, and you have to say, well, this is probably 100% wrong. And now it's 180 degrees off the truth, completely the opposite direction of the truth. And that happens over and over and over again. It was happening with their reporting on the border. It's happens on their reporting about ICE. It happens on all that. And it happens on their reporting about guns. So that's something to think about and definitely take into consideration when you're making choices for media. Okay, let's get into our special edition here and go just with Q&A for the rest of the podcast. And this is my favorite part. I love these things. People ask me these things everywhere. I live in a nice Midwest community where being into guns is not a bad thing. So there are people who ask me a lot of questions about shooting, and a lot of things come up in conversations. And sometimes I just take down the question. I'll answer it, but then I'll take down the question saying, well, this is something others might have an interest in also. So I'll go. The first question I have, and these are in no particular order of relevance or anything else. They basically just, if I write them down, they just go on a piece of paper, and they start at the top and end somewhere at the bottom. So why is a national gun registry illegal? And again, this came out of a conversation about the two shootings. And why can't we just have a database for cars or a database for boats? Why can't we just have something where we immediately flash a serial number and poof, there it is, come up? And in a utopian sense, that sounds like that would be a very prudent thing to have and would make a lot of sense. It would be a common sense thing to have. Here's why we don't. As a part of, they've never actually wanted to do that. And that's been codified by the Firearms Owners Protection Act of 1986, which made a national gun registry illegal. Okay, so it's illegal to do that. Now, I guess that could be turned over by another law of Congress. It's not a Supreme Court ruling or a constitutional issue, but there is legislation passed in 1986 that did that. Now, the Firearms Owner Protection Act of 1986 was a super good piece of legislation, except for one thing. An amendment was added with a voice vote at the last moment, and what that did was that closed the registration of and manufacture of legal machine guns. It closed the registry so that you could not have any more legal machine guns, you could not make any more. The existing ones were still there. So essentially we were frozen at a 1986 level. And I think there was a few months before it was implemented and people were registering, you know, all kinds of things as they could. But the fact of the matter is it had the effect that Class 3 weapons skyrocketed in value and went from hundreds of dollars to thousands of dollars. One case in particular, in the early 80s, I was interested in a Thompson M1A1, you know, the full real deal, select fire real deal. You could get the West Hurley made ones, which were new. They weren't World War II surplus. These were made by Auto Ordnance and West Hurley, and they were current production guns. And you could get with the stamp and everything else, you could get into them for about $1,000, which was a lot of money back then. You know, you think that a new Pontiac Trans Am in 1982 or 1983 cost about $14,000. $1,000 was a lot of money, but you could achieve that. Literally 10 years later, early 90s, those same guns were $7,000, $8,000, $9,000. Now they sell for about $15,000. And, you know, there's very few fully automatic firearms or select firearms that are reasonably priced. I think everything goes for $5,000 or $6,000 and at the minimum. And those are the very low-end things that are out there. So, you know, that's what it did. And so that it was a very good piece of legislation, except for that. But the reason we don't have a national gun registry is for that. And before that, there had always been a lot of resistance to registering firearms. I remember my parents had a bumper sticker on the car, and this is what it said: register communists, not firearms. And, you know, that's how people thought. And that's still how I think, but, you know, registering a firearm is a prelude to confiscation, and that's why it was put into that act. The reason why it's illegal is so it does not become a prelude for confiscation. Now, there are obviously databases that have guns, and it's from the seller or importer to the dealer, and there's all kinds of ways they can trace it, but there is no national registry, so they can't just say, hey, you know, we see that you own 7 guns, give them over, you know, give them over. That's what's on our registry. The other side of the coin is, if you think the federal government could keep a national gun registry straight, that would have even a very conservative thing, even 100 million guns, and there's more than that in the country. If we even 100 million guns would be fantastic. It would be a fantastic effort to try to manage a database with those, with the numbers that are sold, and you know, somebody passes away, somebody else inherits them. You know, it would be just too ponderous to try to manage that. And I think that's another reason there's no real taste for that. I think that the real danger is that they would try to make AR-15s a Class 3 weapon. You know, that would be the kind of thing. And there's precedent for that. I think they did that with the SPAS 12 and the Street Sweeper. You know, the trying to make those because they looked mean, even though they were both very inefficient firearms. Because they looked mean and had a reputation from, you know, the movies and television, predominantly the movies, that, you know, those things were super bad and had to be controlled as Class 3 weapons. And they've done that to a few other things, made it a Class 3 weapon. So that's the big danger. But a national gun registry at this point just cannot happen. Here's an interesting historical question. What long arms did Lewis and Clark use on their expedition, you know, the Corps of Discovery that went out and basically explored the Louisiana Purchase? And from what I've seen, the answer to that is pretty simple. Interestingly, they took an air rifle with them, and they've got one of these in the, I think, the National Firearms Museum, the NRA Museum in Fairfax, Virginia, and I think they have a couple in the Smithsonian. You know, it was something that you pumped up. It works like an air rifle today. They pumped up this globe of air, pressurized air, and it fired a like a 50 caliber big pellet. It was actually a round ball, but a big pellet out of it. And apparently that was very impressive to the tribes and indigenous people that they ran across. So they had that, but the primary long arm was the U.S. model 1795 Springfield musket, a flintlock smoothbore musket, pretty unremarkable, except for one reason. It was superior to the Brown Bess. It fired a slightly smaller projectile. It was flatter shooting. It actually had better range. The Brown Bess actually had pretty poor range, and it was supposedly good enough that it actually gave a kind of a tactical advantage during the War of 1812. You know, the troops equipped with those essentially could outrange. You know, muskets weren't very accurate. They weren't rifled now. It was smoothbore, so they could outrange the British opponents. It was also used in the Mexican War, and it was also used in the Civil War. Some of them, by that time, many of them had been converted to a cap lock, you know, percussion. But some of them were still in the original 1795 guys. And it lives on today in symbology as the branch symbol of the U.S. Army Infantry Branch. They're crossed 1795 flintlock rifles, muskets, and I believe that was one of the first ones that was actually produced. I think prior to that, we had probably purchased or had, you know, the captured muskets from the Revolutionary War, but the 1795, I think, was the first indigenously produced one, and it came out of, one of the first things out of Springfield Armory. So it was a very, very very, very good weapon. Very, very excellent. And unfortunately, I don't think any from the Lewis and Clark expeditions survive in museums because, you know, that was an expensive undertaking. So when they came back, anything they had that was kind of saleable, the government sold. They held a sale and said, hey, who wants to buy this? And they sold a whole bunch of the stuff. All these, you know, what we would now consider to be American history icons and irreplaceable artifacts from the Lewis and Clark expedition literally went under the hammer. So that was what they used, and that's what happened to them. Well, here's an interesting question that was directed at me in a conversation, and I won't bore you with all the details because the question kind of encapsulates it. You don't think highly of prepping. What firearms are best for an emergency or a natural disaster? Okay, it's not that I don't think highly of prepping. I just think that basically a lot of people who are doing the doomsday prepping thing are wasting their time. There's a whole reason for that. My first reason is you're not gonna. It's a fantasy to think that you're going to take your weapon, whatever it is, and go out and fight the gang of marauders that are going to come trying to steal the stuff that you know, have carefully squirreled away, or the raid the little farmette that's self-sufficient that you live on. It's just not going to happen. I mean, you know, 20 or 30 people, even armed with relatively primitive or less useful firearms are just going to overwhelm you. So it's there's a fantasy out there that somehow if you have a high enough capacity in effective enough rifle that you're gonna basically mow these guys down. They're gonna go away and leave you and go find an easier target. I mean, seems like fantasy to me. That's why I don't think much of it. I also don't think much of these guys who just squirrel away tens of thousands of rounds of ammunition without the intention of ever using it, except in some sort of a end of the world, or the more correct terms are world without rule of law, or, you know, I don't know, they've got several acronyms for this, including if the shit hits the fan, whatever all that means. And I saw this was about, when was it, about 15 years ago, they were bringing in all kinds of surplus, it was corrosive surplus 7.62x25 ammunition, basically PPSH submachine gun ammunition. I suppose you could use it in a Tokarev pistol, but a lot of that stuff was loaded pretty hot. So anyway, you have all this hot loaded corrosive military ammunition coming in, and they were selling it super cheap. I mean, this stuff was being sold for just pennies on the dollar, really. I mean, it was very, very cheap. I think it was well under $100 for 1,000 or 1,500 rounds. Well, you had some of these prepper guys bought it, and they would buy an AR-15 upper that was chambered in it and get a magazine adapter so they could use some sort of magazine with it. And there you go. All of a sudden, they're using, they've got all this stuff, and they've got tens of thousands of rounds, so that when the world ends, the rule of law ends, and it's basically the wild, wild west. And you've seen this in any number of the dystopian future movies. Then they're basically going to have this giant cache of ammo and be able to repel any and all invaders. And this stuff they're going to use after they've used up their conventional 5.56 or whatever, and then convert their guns to use this. It's just pure fantasy, and it's just purely a ridiculous, it's a waste of resources. I mean, you know, to buy several thousand dollars worth of ammo that you never will use, I mean, it might give you peace of mind, but storing it and everything else is going to be a real pain. Yeah, you don't really want to move very much if you've done that. The other thing is, a lot of military surplus, and I've got a story related to this, is stuff that's just beyond or just at the end of its, I don't want to say useful life, but it's certainly its combat useful life. And, you know, I ran into some 303 British. It was actually cordite stuff, I mean, from the 60s, 1960s, and it does hang fire, you know. I mean, out of a 30-round box, you'll probably get one or two duds and a couple of hang fires, and that's just the reality of that kind of ammunition. It's at the end of its life. It has been stored, and to be honest, it's starting to degrade enough, the primers are degrading enough, so that if you hold it another 50 years, who knows? It could be half the box is duds and the rest are hang fires. Who knows? You don't know. This isn't pristine stuff that just rolled off the assembly line. And it's the same thing with some of the Comblock stuff. You know, you get some of this, and a lot of the Comblock stuff was corrosive because, hey, they didn't care. You know, they were, corrosive primers were longer lasting and could handle different climates like the tropics and things notionally better. I think the real reason they kept stuck with it was that's what they made. That's what the factory was. This was communism. There was no real reward for saying, hey, if we change this, we can make a cleaner primer. They just didn't care. So, you know, this stuff is all corrosive. It's old. If it's 50 years old, you know, what are you going to do? Hold it for another 50 years? You know, who shoots 100-year-old ammo? You can. I wouldn't want to do it in a combat situation, though, or a life and death situation. So that's why I think that's kind of ridiculous to do that. Anyway, that's why I don't really think a whole lot of prepping, the doomsday prepping. Now, what I will say is I do have you know, I'm like everybody else. I've got like two cases of MREs. I've got some camping stuff that I could use if I were without power for a week or two. I usually keep a couple flats of water. You know, stuff like that is prudent. Even the U.S. government tells you, they tell you to do that. They tell you to have, 72 hours worth of food and water, you know, in your house. FEMA put that out. They don't say diddly about weapons. They don't say anything about self-protection, but they will tell you, keep some food and water. That'll keep you going. I also got, like everybody else who's ever done any kind of camping or anything, a couple old sleeping bags. So even if it's in the winter, you know, you can curl up inside of sleeping bags and throw quilts and things on top of you, and you'll stay warm. I mean, it won't be pleasurable, but you'd at least would not have to vacate your home. And in that sort of scenario, I think any firearm you have is useful. I mean, they're very, very useful. You're not going to defend your house against the hordes. I mean, that's not really what this is about. This is more about, hey, something like that's happened. Hey, if you leave your house, you know, there is the opportunity that looters could show up there and say, hey, there's an abandoned house. Let's see what's inside and come in and loot your place. If you're in there, chances are they're not. But if they did and you're armed, you're going to be doing okay. Now, if it's 100 people coming in, you're going to have a problem. But that's usually not the way looters act in a natural disaster or, you know, power grid down kind of environment. It's usually kind of single group. There might be groups of people wandering the street, but resistance will definitely turn them the other way. And especially if you've talked to your neighbors and everybody's kind of resisting, you'll definitely do that. But in something like that, any hunting firearms are going to be useful. A 30-30 lever gun is going to be useful. Even 22s are going to be very useful. A 10-22 with a 30-round magazine and any kind of an optical scope on it is going to be very, very useful. And those are low, you know, that's a low-priced firearm. So, you know, the firearms you have are probably going to be at least sufficient. If you want to optimize it, yes, then go with, you know, the AR, and you can set up an M4 with an EOTech or an aimpoint and all the goodies, and you'll have a very, very capable weapon for when it comes to self-defense. But essentially, there are a lot of good weapons out there that would do that. So I'd tell people that, you know, if you want to go buy a weapon, go buy one. But you don't need to use this as an excuse to go buy it. You can say, well, if this ever happened, this would be useful. But most people, if you want to buy a weapon, just go ahead and buy it. You don't need to use that as an excuse. When it comes to natural disaster, I'll tell you this right now that, you know, sometimes firearms are the farthest thing from your mind. I mean, you know, I used to live in Paradise, California, and we all know what happened there last year. There was a big fire, and it basically wiped out the town. Now, when I lived there, it was 20 years ago, but they still had that same fear that, hey, you know, we're out here in the woods, and, you know, they were always talking about fire breaks and having to do more fire mitigation. Well, they never did it for environmental reasons and tree hugger, love the earth reasons, and the town paid for it. They lost 1,000 homes. So there's no weapon, no firearm is going to stop a fire. And after a fire races through and burns your house down, there's probably nothing left to loot. So now if you've evacuated and your home is just sitting there, yeah, people can come in. But usually when that happens, they have a very, you know, there's usually some control there. It's not like it's without rule of law and there's nothing. There's usually some control there, especially in the smaller towns. I went through a hurricane in Hinesville, Georgia a few years ago, and it was the same thing. I mean, the police were out in force, and they actually closed the county. If you left the county, you weren't coming back. And we were stuck in a hotel without power for a few days and, you know, just kind of eating munchies and wondering when things were going to happen. You know, just waiting for they had a big reserve water tank, and so that's how the toilets kept flushing. And the other thing was the door locks, which are all electronic now, were on batteries. So at a certain point, that battery, I don't know how long those last, but, you know, at a certain point, the little card they give you as a key isn't going to work anymore. So the whole thing was – you know, it was pretty scary. And you don't know what's going to happen. But again, no firearm is going to stop a hurricane. No firearm is going to stop a fire. And in fact, just a few months ago, we had an F4 or F5, I think they're still debating what it is, tornado landed near my home. And in fact, it got up off the ground a mile away, and we lost a couple of trees, and the yard was a big mess, but the house was undamaged. And I can tell you that no firearm is going to stop a hurricane. And, you know, power was out and everything else. And essentially what we did was, you know, we kind of toughed it out. And, you know, I didn't find that there was a need for anything other than the usual home security firearms. There wasn't any need for anything in addition to that. It wasn't like, hey, go break out the M60 machine gun, you know, or nobody was thinking like that. It was just like, well, whatever you have, if you use a shotgun or a pistol for home defense, that's what you're still going to use for home defense, because there was no organized looting or any mayhem or anything associated with that. So there are a lot of things to consider when you consider how to prepare for these types of things, which can happen. And you know, warmth, water, food, and all that is almost co-equal with security. You know, a lot of guys want to use these type of situations as, I need to buy 3 or 4 more guns. Well, maybe you do, and maybe you do, but if you want to buy them, just because you want them is reason enough. Okay. The next question is, this is a good one. InRange TV thinks M1 carbines suck. Is that true? The answer is, like a lot of things on InRange TV, it is not what they say it is. It is not true. You know, I've seen a couple of their shows where they have M1 carbines, and frankly, I'm not very impressed. Again, I'm not very impressed with their opinions or their testing. And here's the reason, one of the reasons, is that there are M1 carbines and then there are M1 carbines. U.S. military M1 carbine production ceased in 1945. And all the manufacturers together, and you can look on the internet and see everybody from Rockola to Inland to Winchester to IBM. I mean, all these people have made them. And mine was made by Underwood Typewriter Company. So anyway, all these companies turned out like 6.5 million of these things during World War II. I mean, production was rolling. And for decades, we gave them out to any friendly country as a foreign military assistance, or we sold it to them under foreign military credits, or, you know, any you know, we armed our allies with, and a lot of those carbines went to that. So U.S. military carbines are a lot different than the commercial copies that came out after the war. And by after the war, I mean, really, I think it was the 1960s when the surplus carbines that the DCM was selling, when those dried up, commercial manufacturers stepped in and produced carbines of varying quality. I mean, go on the internet forums and they'll talk about Plainfield versus Universal. And there were some carbines that were cobbled back together. The receivers had been destroyed and the two pieces welded back together, sometimes called rewelds, but it's actually a weld because they're not being rewelded. They're being welded. The two pieces. So there were a lot of those kind of things out on the market. And so the carbine has a very interesting reputation. And I think there may have even been some cast carbine receivers on the market at one time or another, going back. But be all that as it may, U.S. military carbines are good, reliable weapons. They're good, reliable weapons. Now, you can say they're not the most powerful, but they are good and reliable. The commercial copies, even including up to the ones made in this day, are, you know, some of them are questionable. And they don't have the government inspections. They don't have the armory inspection. They don't have that whole quality inspection regimen that the U.S. military carbines had. So I don't know if what InRange TV's experience is with strict military carbines. versus the commercial ones. I know they've done a couple things on the commercial ones where they tried to run it through their two-gun action challenge match, and it didn't do very well. But that was a commercial one. Got to remember, even the most of the military ones now have been in civilian hands for decades. So, you know, it's kind of a box of chocolates. You don't know what you're going to get. Maybe it's well cared for and in excellent condition, or maybe it's been used very hard and some of the parts are very worn. But if you have a good condition carbine, it's going to be a very reliable and reasonably accurate rifle for what it is. And every malfunction I've seen with a carbine like that is usually magazine induced, because in addition to the GI magazines that are out there, which are pretty good, there are varying quality commercial copies. Most of them are pretty good. Most of them are pretty good, but there's probably some out there. And it's a somewhat frail magazine. It's kind of a thin metal magazine, sheet metal magazine, and it can, the lips can dent. And a lot of these magazines now are 70, 75 years old. So, you know, it's, you know, it is in many ways an antique gun, and a lot of the parts for it are antique. It's not the 1960s anymore. You know, it's not 50 or 60 years ago when these things were relatively new. So I think it's a little unfair to judge them or say they suck simply because the example you have is a commercial copy of a military gun, and it is maybe firing magazines of unknown and questionable heritage. So that's what I would say about that. I would also say that today we actually had a kind of a fun event where we were firing some carbines, and this is close range. And it was like, how many bullets can you launch downrange and hit the target? Not just spray and pray, but actually aimed fire and hit the target. And we were probably doing that at 30, 35 yards, something like that. And I'll tell you, M1 carbines, there were three of them next to me. I was on the end of the line, and there were three M1 carbines next to me. And they put out a withering amount of fire. And this is aimed fire. This isn't just pull the trigger like a goofball. This was aimed fire. And they put out a withering fire. And I tell you this, I was sitting there going, I would not want to be on the other end of that. And this was only three carbines. So you can imagine in World War II, where the Germans or the Japanese kind of break through and they're coming up against some sort of logistics or artillery or some sort of unit that's really predominantly equipped with carbines, basically under 100 yards, there's going to be withering fire out there. It was very, very impressive. Normally when we see carbines fire, it's, you know, at a CMP type event or something where they're firing, you know, a very set piece. This was something different. This was fire as quick, aimed shots as quickly as you can. And one gentleman fired, I didn't keep round counts, but he fired 147 rounds in 5 minutes of aimed fire, and they were hitting the man-sized target. And this was fast. I mean, if you had a bonsai charge coming, these guys could have stopped it because they were putting out fire. I mean, it was very, very impressive. And at close range like that, some of the carbines' stopping power questions and a few things really don't come into play, because it's close and it's going to be, you know, towards the top end of its ballistic effectiveness. So I would say that looking at that as opposed to the two-gun action challenge match where these guys can't get the carbine working and the rear sight falls off, we saw nothing like that. And in fact, we saw very, very excellent reliability. And on one or two where they did have like a stovepipe or something, the immediate action on a carbine is so fast. It's better than an AR. It's better than an AK. That open action, you know, all you do is just rack that charging handle again, and you're back in business. And it has a very short throw because it's a short cartridge. And it was very impressive that weapon could get back into action that quickly. So the M1 carbine, again, should not be underestimated. And, you know, again, people who've never been infantrymen and or cannot make a judgment about something by looking at it saying, how would this weapon perform in some other venue other than what they're used to, which is an individual match, scenario-based match. Definitely a squad or a section of people with M1 carbines is much more formidable than what they can understand. The other thing that was very impressive is how quickly the magazine changes go. The M1 carbine, you can change the magazine on that very quickly. The controls are very intuitive, and it's very good. You do have to hit that magazine. It's not a flared magazine well, but you can hit it quite effectively, and you can carry a lot around. The rounds are light, the magazines are light. You can carry a lot of ammunition. You could carry 300 to 400 rounds of that, and yeah, you're going to know you're carrying something. But I tell you, it's when it comes to something like the ammunition for a Thompson or the ammunition for an M1 rifle, you can carry a lot more for the same weight. So it was a very, very effective and kind of an eye-opening thing. You know, I always like it when there's grand matches or something where unusual guns are being fired in numbers, because there you can kind of get the sense of what it would be like if these things were being fired on a section or squad level. The only other thing that's really close to that is the old infantry rattle battle that they used to do, and maybe they still do it at the national matches. That has some of the same elements to it. And that's one thing that a lot of the content creators just don't do. They just don't factor that in, that maybe the G3 is a slow rifle. But when you have a squad shooting them, some of its slowness, some of the awkwardness is really camouflaged because there's always somebody firing and covering the guys who are reloading. Okay, here's another question. Why do people believe the 5.56 in the AR-15 M16 is one of the most powerful rifle rounds available, even more powerful than larger hunting rounds that are designed for big game? Well, the answer to that is very, very simply. Most people get their information from television and the movies, and television and the movies will lead you to believe that the 5.56 cartridge is much more powerful than a lot of other things. And effectively, it is an intermediate cartridge. It is not especially powerful, but it, compared to its predecessors, the 7.62 NATO or the Ball M2 30 caliber that we call the 30-06, it really is less powerful. It is less powerful than a 300 Magnum deer rifle. It is less powerful than even a 22-250 varmint rifle. It is less powerful than the 243 Winchester. But people get this impression from television and the movies, and as I said at the beginning of the podcast, the faulty media reporting, the inaccurate, biased, sensationalist stuff. So people out there believe that the AR-15 is this military-grade weapon that has this uber powerful cartridge in a huge capacity, and that's why it's being used to massacre people. When in point of fact, really almost none of those things are precisely true. The AR-15 itself would never be used by any military because it's not select fire. It's just not, nobody ever uses that. The only one I ever saw in a combat zone, an AR that was not select fire, was in the hands of a DOJ guy, and he showed up with one magazine. He showed up with that rifle with one magazine. It was a carry handle. It looked like an M4 type thing. It was definitely an off the shelf buy. Now, it wasn't a bad rifle. It was a Bushmaster. It was a nice rifle. It was reliable and everything else. But I would not have traded my M4 for it. I would not have traded my EOTech equipped M4 for it at all because it didn't have the burst control. It was single and semi. And, you know, for a guy who's a DOJ guy who, you know, everybody, I think, in that combat zone needed to be armed in some fashion. It's not a horrible choice, but it's definitely not what the rest of us would have had, and we never would have equipped a U.S. military unit with that. And so, you know, it is not a military grade weapon. The 5.56 is an intermediate cartridge. It is not uber powerful. It is not a death ray. It cannot shoot down airplanes or knock out tanks, which is what they will tell you or lead you to believe. And in fact, it is a standard capacity with other weapons in its class. So it's not any of those things that they say. But the reason people believe it is because of television. Okay, we have two M14 rifle questions coming up. And I've dealt with the M14 rifle and why it was adopted over the FNFAL ad nauseum. And this is not about that. This one is a little more broad question. What is the deal with the M14 as a sniper rifle? Well, first of all, when the M14 was adopted, I don't think much thought was given to using it as a sniper rifle, even though it had the groove and the hole on the side of the receiver so you could attach a scope mount. After the Korean War, sniping, you know, peacetime army and the Pentomic army of the 1950s, where they were more fascinated with nuclear battlefield, tactical nuclear weapons as opposed to kind of any other kind of fighting that would involve sniper. Sniping really wasn't a priority. So that was just way on the back burner, if on any burner at all. The M14 really didn't become a sniper rifle until actually when it was being replaced in service, at least in the early part, in the mid-1960s by the M16 series. You know, first it went all the way up to eventually the M16A1. So when the tactical requirement for sniping generated by the Vietnam War came about, suitable rifles were out there, and the Marine Corps stuck with a Remington 700 derivative known as the M40, which, you know, was a good bolt-action accurate rifle. The Army went with the M21, which was a basically an accurized and scope-mounted version of the M14, and I do believe the Marines may have used some also. I think that especially when it came to mounting night vision on it and things. These were good rifles. They worked. They had a longer range than the M16A1. They could mount superior optics. You know, the AR could mount the little 3 and 4 power scopes, which were a nice optical aid, but they weren't sniper rifle scopes by any stretch. And the M14 had a good run with being a sniper rifle. But when it was adopted, the Army was much more focused on the M15 and the M14E2, which would replace the BAR. And it turned out to be an abject failure because the barrel was not heavy enough to be able to absorb the heat. If you've ever seen a BAR, they do have a very heavy barrel, and that barrel operates as a heat sink. But with all automatic rifles and light machine guns, and there is a difference between the two, once they heat up, you've got a problem. You've got to figure out how to cool them down again or let them cool down on their own because you can't swap the barrel out. So, you know, the thought of that this was going to be an effective squad automatic weapon was just not there. You just couldn't change the barrel. And the big 30 caliber rounds heat up a barrel very quickly. Part of the beauty of the M249 squad automatic weapon currently in service is it's 5.56. It has a heavier barrel than the M16s, and it can cool down. And the 5.56 does not generate the heat that the 7.62 NATO does. So that was an abject failure. But there are a couple of archival photographs around showing that wonderful piece of military equipment, the M84 scope mounted to the heavy barrel M15, and I suppose that was some precursor sniper type setup, because the heavy barrel would be thought to be more accurate, whether it was or not, and whether it is with the bipod that was issued with the M14E2 is very questionable. But, you know, there was a little bit of lip service paid to that, but it really didn't get serious till the Vietnam War. And the XM21, the M21 became the a very good rifle. They were kept in stocks through the 70s, 80s, with a 3-9 variable, kind of the Art II scope. Was the favorite. Turns out that was not really a great scope, but it was sufficient. I mean, it was sufficient. When you're talking that sniping in those days was not the high-end capability people talk about now, where we're not talking about 2,000 yards or 1,500 yards. We're really talking 300 to 600 yards, which, you know, you can do with iron sights. I mean, you can do that with iron sights, but a scope gives you superior target identification. It gives you some magnification and a single aiming plane. So therefore, you know, that's really what they were looking for. You really don't see, it's very difficult to find an enemy target, especially in an environment like Vietnam, basically farther away than that. That's what it was there. It was used through the Gulf War. It was used, and it was also used through the war in Iraq. I'm sure there's some out there somewhere. I know some have been refurbished by commercial companies and all the rest of it. And it's a good system. It works. It's a good system. There's all kinds of things out there now. The military has bought all kinds of things, and it's hard to keep up with. But they've had essentially AR-10 based, SR-25 based type of 7.62 NATO AR style weapons that have been out there, and all the rest. But the M14 has given good service. I know it gets disparaged by some of the people on the internet, but. And YouTube, but the fact of the matter is it was very effective, and people liked the power, they liked the range, and they liked the reliability and just the ease of using it. It's a very easy gun, good gun to use. So that's the deal with it as a sniper rifle, as far as I know. A lot of people, like I said, disparage it. They talk about, well, it's hard to keep in, blah, 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 hard to keep in good repair and everything else. But, well, so is everything else that's precision that's in a military environment, because military environment breeds abuse. Stuff gets knocked around. Stuff gets hauled. People jump over obstacles. People land hard. People are on rooftops, and you know, things collapse around them, and they got to scurry away, you know, scramble away. So this stuff does take a beating, and so none of them, I think, are really superior in that regard. But they're all very useful. Okay, a related question is, why was the M14 replaced in NATO? It would have made sense to keep it in service there during the 1970s and 1980s because it was in the 7.62 NATO cartridge, which was the common NATO cartridge. Okay, the answer to that is pretty simple. The M14 did serve longer in Germany than it did in Vietnam and probably CONUS. I think it served in CONUS probably the longest. But anyway, there was a big revelation, and the revelation was, we've developed the wrong rifle for the wrong war. And one thing the Army hates more than anything is multi-calibers. And although they were stuck with 7.62 NATO for the M60 machine gun and a few other weapons they had, like the M134 minigun and all that, and it's a very useful cartridge, they did not want to have two general issue rifle cartridges, even though they were on opposite parts of the globe. So therefore, that was one reason. Another reason was the public outcry would have been huge if we're equipping. And at that time, we were equipping the South Vietnamese Army with M16s, and yet our own troops, our own boys over in NATO, are getting the older M14s, which were basically deemed not as good as the AK-47, not as effective as the AK-47 in combat. So there would have been a huge outcry with that. Plus the closing of Springfield Armory, all those things kind of came together and basically said, the M14 is done. And it hung on as a sniper rifle and, a few other things, but its day was over, and it was going to be replaced by the M16 as a universal rifle for all the troops. Simplified training, simplified a whole lot of things. Now, it did not make our European allies very happy at all, because only 15 years before, we basically said, you're going to adopt the 7.62 NATO, which we have developed. You're going to adopt this, and that's what it's going to be. And I wasn't the 7.62 NATO at the time. I think it was, T-25 or whatever it was, whatever the cartridge designation was. But it became the 7.62 by 51 NATO. Everybody bought rifles for it, except the French and the Swiss, were not part of NATO. But a lot of people around the world, FN was tooling up. They were selling FALs around the world. The Germans would tool up, and they would sell G3s overseas as well. And it looked like what it was, which was kind of a reversal of policy that they would eventually have to keep up with. And they did. And, they hung on for until the early 80s when they developed the SS-109 cartridge, which became the 855, the 62-grain 5.56 round, which we then put in a 1-in-7 twist barrel on the M16A2, which was our improvement over the M16A1. And, they eventually started adopting 5.56 weapons. And that's where that went. But in theory, yes, NATO could have been equipped a lot longer. The U.S. forces in NATO could have been equipped a lot longer with M14s, and it wouldn't have made much difference at all. But, I kind of give them credit. They realized, hey, there's another way. Small arms are going another way, and as much as we like the grand system, this is not the way forward, and they took the other approach. And a lot of people blame McNamara, and you can hear all that stuff on YouTube, all the things. But the fact of the matter is, it was a brilliant decision, and it gave us an absolutely outstanding rifle. And the funny part is, you don't really see M16A1s in U.S. military service anymore. Haven't for decades, but you still see the M14 here and there. So it really did kind of, in many ways, even though it hung on as a specialty rifle, it outlasted its successor, which is always kind of a cool thing. All right, here is our last question, and it's kind of we've touched on this before, but not quite in this way. Why are modern polymer-framed pistols considered so much better than older designs like the 1911, the Browning High Power, the Smith & Wesson Model 59, and the Beretta M9? Well, I can tell you that there's several reasons for that. Number one is these new polymer-framed pistols have durability and reliability, and it may be better than the older pistols. I don't think anybody's ever going to shoot it enough to know, but yes, you can. You can wear out all pistols, but the polymer frame pistols do have an excellent reputation for durability, reliability. The design of them is all functionally the same. I mean, it's even if they have a thumb safety, they usually have the trigger safety, which is a little flap you have to depress, and then the trigger is released, and you can fire. Keep pressing the trigger and fire it. There's a whole lot of reasons. Number one is, if you're running a shooting school, you definitely want everybody to show up with a polymer frame pistol that's not going to give you any trouble. So you're not thinking about, do I have to repair something? Does this or that have to do? If somebody brings a bad magazine for a Glock, there's going to be other Glocks around. They can get a magazine, borrow a magazine, or go buy another one, and it's good. If you show up with a Smith & Wesson Model 59, you're probably going to have a hard time finding a replacement magazine if you lose, bend, or one of yours just doesn't work. So that's part of it. The same thing with the Browning High Power. You know, you just don't go into a store these days and find a Browning High Power magazine. You can still find Beretta magazines, and you can still find 1911 magazines, but you're not going to find them for some of these other designs. The other thing is a lot of the other designs, and I have to take the Browning and the 1911 are out of this, but they are double action, single action designs, which are just out of favor now. None of these trainers like those. None of these trainers like them. So if you show up with your M9, they're going to say you should get something else because your first round hit ability with that double action pull is going to be degraded. So they don't like that. The single action pistols like the Browning and the 1911, they don't like because nobody likes that cocked hammer. Even though I would opine that the polymer pistols have a cocked hammer also. They got a cocked striker, and it's essentially the same. And in fact, I think the safety mechanisms on a 1911 are superior. You have a grip safety and a thumb safety, and you know, so you actually have two safeties involved, whereas the striker-fired pistols normally just have that little flap on the trigger, which, you know, is not my favorite thing. But appearance is everything, and appearance of a cocked pistol is unacceptable in law enforcement. It's unacceptable in a lot of places. Nobody really likes that. So consequently, that's another reason that people poo-poo them. You know, there's a lot of, if you're gonna fire, it depends. A lot of people have lost track of what a pistol really is. And a pistol is kind of an emergency or secondary arm. You're not going to be out there firing a whole lot, especially as an armed civilian. You're not going to be firing a whole lot of rounds with your pistol. You're going to be firing to escape. And the reason the high capacity pistols are nice is you can fire three or four rounds, five rounds at the bad guy, force them to duck and take cover, and you can escape. You know, it's also nice that you can fire 10, 12, 15, even 17 rounds, and before you have to reload. So it's a nice pistol to have if you need that capacity. The older designs really don't have that, even though you can get extended magazines for the Beretta, and you can get probably some for the Browning. The 1911 is a bit more problematic, but you know, that's just it. And a lot of people now kind of carry, they won't really advertise this, but if you've got a 17 round 9 millimeter pistol and you're carrying it, you may not carry a lot of spare magazines, if any, because you're not going to need 60 rounds of ammo for your average CCW encounter. You're not going to need maybe 10% of that, you know, and that, which is why revolvers are still, you know, kind of popular little weapons to carry around. So, but in these shooting schools where they shoot hundreds of rounds, that's all a big deal. I kind of laugh. There's one guy, Mr. Delta Force, who says, "Well, you know, the 1911 is really an enthusiast weapon, blah blah blah." Well, we have anecdotal evidence from two world wars and two limited wars, which says very different. And the reason it's different is because, you know, the 1911 A1, the 1911 was just, you know, you don't use it that much in a military context. The number of rounds, for anyone who's actually fired a pistol in combat, the number of rounds they've fired is minuscule. It's usually a last ditch. I need this. I pull it out. I shoot and go. You don't go with it as your primary weapon. So, for military use, they don't get the thousands of rounds fired through them that people might think. For police, yes, they fire it more. But you know, look at the condition of police trade-ins. Some of those are in really good shape because the guy qualifies when he has to, and he carries it around. So it gets some holster wear, and it's very, very low round count on the gun. Everything else is still basically new and working quite well. Usually with a police trade-in, the biggest mitigator on price isn't, "Oh, these things have been used and worn out." It's never that. It's, "Hey, they've been carried in rainstorms and snowstorms, and the finish is kind of scruffy and messed up." And that's usually what brings a price down on a police trade-in. Not that they've been shot so much that they're worn out. So that's why people think that the polymer designs are better. They're being told they're better. I'm a traditionalist. I don't believe what people tell me. I believe what I know and what I can see and how I can determine things. And while I have nothing against the polymer frame guns, I don't think they represent the generational or evolutionary leap that a lot of people want to give them credit for. And I think a lot of them can shoot just fine. And you can shoot just as well with one as you can the newer pistol. I think sometimes the newer pistol is kind of a talisman. People think it's going to be more effective than it is. The nice part about polymer pistols, though, is that they've lowered the price point. You know, if you were still trying to use a Smith & Wesson 38 special adjustable sight revolver, that's going to be a very expensive weapon to produce and to keep up and everything else. That's going to be expensive. Polymer frame, 9mm, it's going to be half the cost. And basically, it's going to require very little maintenance. So, you know, it's the same thing with other guns too. The reliability, durability, and low maintenance costs are really playing in the polymer pistol's favor. Plus, there is not the emphasis on marksmanship that people had. People aren't looking for a gun that can shoot a cloverleaf group at 25 yards. They're looking at a gun that can keep its shots in the kill zone of whatever tactical target they're using at, you know, maximum 25 yards and probably more like 15 yards. So some of the standards have changed as well. And some of the older guns were built to a little bit different standard, at least in the commercial models. I realize 1911A1 and the military Browning high power might not, but a lot of people don't shoot pistols for target anymore. They use it for much more use firing at a steel target that falls over or tings than it is to shoot and try to hit the X-ring of an NRA conventional target. So anyway, that's what we kind of think about that. And as always, we welcome your comments. You can hit them. You can put them on Podbean, and you can add a comment there. I will get to it. I do get a notification when a comment is put in there. And again, like I said at the top of the podcast, you can go ahead and hit any of those buttons that'll help you out there. I'd like to have a few more subscribers, like to have a few more followers, likes, and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, until next time, this is Old School Guns. Out.